Hi, everybody. Welcome to the second day of the colloquium or symposium on human-computer partnerships. And I would like to introduce Baptiste Caramiaux, who is a chargé de recherche at CNRS and at the Sorbonne University. And we've known each other for a while now, and I'm really enthusiastic about hearing your work that you've done at IRCAM, at University of Paris-Saclay, and also at Sorbonne now.
Thank you very much, Wendy. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for organizing this symposium. It's an honor to be here and to do this talk today. So, good morning, everyone. I choose actually to talk about maybe more in progress or recent work in order to fit the seminar, and maybe also to produce some discussion in this idea of human-computer partnership. So I'm going to try to give some pointers towards some works that I've done with colleagues and students and postdocs around this idea of rethinking interaction with machine learning. I know that the title might seem very ambitious, but I mean that's also a way to start discussing what it means to rethink interaction with this kind of technology. And I will start by showing you this image that is an ecosystem of services and products involving machine learning, artificial intelligence, or data science. And we see that it's very vast, and obviously this is not even exhaustive. But this picture shows pretty well a landscape created by this investment company. And it highlights pretty well how diverse and transversal the technology has become, from application in infrastructure, and actually it resonates with some talks that we had yesterday, and also application in actually end user application. That's where actually I situate myself and my research. So more machine learning that is deployed and used in applications that are then embedded in mobile phones, in computers that are used by end users that are usually novices in machine learning, that are not necessarily expert, or domain expert in another domain than machine learning. But the important thing is that this technology is actually brought towards the everybody. And so when we do that, what we can see is that we can see a common workflow when this technology is embedded and integrated in end-user applications. And I would like to stress this workflow that works like this. So usually we have a system, a machine learning-based system, that accepts inputs and outputs. And we have a series of stakeholders like experts or end users. So usually the experts are the ones that are designing the algorithms. So here is expert in machine learning on AI. So they are designing the model, the algorithms. They are tweaking parameters, changing the models, changing the metrics. The threshold is very iterative and very time-consuming work. And from all these experiments that they do, they receive some metrics to understand if actually the model works well or not. On the other side, the users, so this is the development side of the machine learning-based systems. So on the other side, the users have interaction with the experts or the companies developing the systems by, for instance, sending feedback or data and receiving maybe questions from the company about the experience that they have with the application. And eventually, the interaction that they have with the system is mostly data providers. And so they only experience usage and testing of these systems. And they are mostly not involved in the development of these systems. And I'm not the only one telling that, but this design is actually bringing many breakdowns or issues that I'm listing here, some of them. What we can see is that this design doesn't really, or this workflow doesn't really prevent biases. So what we have seen in the recent years, and also with this breakthrough of deep learning and this spreading over like a lot of different applications, is that biases are actually spotted when the application is already deployed. So we had this example given by Thomas Baudel yesterday about Google Translate translating from Hungarian to French with this gender problem. We had also during COVID we had biases that have been spotted from the Google Vision API, where for instance the thermometer used to test the temperature, when it was held by a white hand, it was classified as an electronic device, but when it was held by a black hand, it was classified as a gun. And that's a problem, obviously, but the problem is also that it's really spotted at the very end of the chain. So it does not prevent biases. And so it also prevents from system auditing by the users themselves. So when you receive this kind of biases, people can react, and basically is what happens, and usually it's on Twitter, Instagram, or social network to make noise, and that's a good way to do it. But maybe we can think about like other way to audit machine learning system by enable, for instance, like exploration of this system, trying to find edge cases, and so on and so forth. And so this design kind of block this type of auditing. Also, I stress, and this has also been illustrated by in Theo's Sanchez talk yesterday, is like this kind of design hinders ML literacy and democratization of the technology, in that sense that the user has no access to the system, so it's not really easy for this user to actually understand what is under the hood, or how he can or she can develop her experience or experience-based skills about this type of systems. And so what we have is like mostly black box systems that are experienced by users. And also I believe that this type of design is also reduces the robust deployment, because one thing that we can see, and myself also work in a startup company developing AI systems back in 7 years ago in London, and basically when you test when you develop system offline and when you try to deploy in the real world, the data are never the same, and so obviously there is a lot of problem of robust deployment. And most, I guess, a lot of companies start actually to develop some more iterative workflow in order to improve this robust deployment. And of course, this type of design reduces transparency, as I already mentioned with the biases. So the point in this talk, my point is actually, can we look to alternative perspectives on this technology and what we can learn from it? And I will stress that it's interesting to look at how artists or creatives are actually looking and using and appropriating this technology. Actually, artists have always been early testers, adopters, critics, hackers of technological innovation, and how they use it and how they change it, or how they repurpose their original design is really interesting. So I put one image by artist Memo Acten. This is back in 7 years ago, and in this work he used a technique developed by Mike Tika to explore convolutional neural networks, to visualize how convolutional neural networks are actually learning from images. So this algorithm was called Inceptionism, and so it's used here by Memo on an image of the UK, the government communication headquarters. Another example is this work is by Kyle MacDonald. So he used this particularity of machine learning that is based on data set and huge data set and annotated data set to create an interactive kind of surveillance website where people can annotate what happens in real time here in Trafalgar Square. And so in a way, it's like a disrupting with this annotation thing, and by providing, by opening this annotation process to anybody, and also that would lead to completely inconsistent annotations. That's very interesting. Third example, this is by Rocío Berenguer. She's based here in Paris, and I put her work because she took a different stance where basically here, machine learning or AI, as she called it, is considered as a subject matter. So here in this piece, G5, Interspecies, she imagined a kind of summit where representative of each of type of species in the Earth is actually meeting in order to talk about the future of our planet. So we have animals, we have minerals, we have vegetals, we have humans, and we have also technology. So from this alternative, so what alternative perspective, I would like maybe to try to start to investigate how we could rethink interaction with machine learning. So now I will first, in this presentation, I will first present a study that we did investigating more with HCI methods more thoroughly how artists are actually involving machine learning and artificial intelligence in their work in order to understand their workflow and many other things that I will present hereafter. Then I will present another part of, from what we learned from the artistic practice, I'm going to present a series of tools or a toolkit that will allow maybe, or that's a proposition to allow to compose and design interactive interaction design with machine learning. And I will give a third example where I will show maybe how we could use interactive generative model here in a clinical and medical context, stemming from what we learned from these two previous studies. So I'm going to start with this study that we conducted where we investigated how artists are using machine learning, or visual artists are using machine learning and artificial intelligence. And I used one quote by Memo to describe himself, like explorers of unknown planets. So this work is in collaboration with Sarah Didier-Lawi, and we had also a workshop paper with Stacy Zwe at CAI this year. So this is I'm starting with these examples by Mario Klingemann. So in this work, why I'm showing this work? Because this work has been kind of advertised. One of the first work that has been that entered the art, contemporary art market, and has been sold at Sotheby's. And Mario is very famous. He's kind of one of the pioneers in the use of generative models and deep learning-based generative models in visual art. And Mario managed to reach this virtuosity using this type of technology. So here, you have like two screens, and actually, it's not an image, it's videos where faces are changing dynamically. And the model behind has been trained with portraits from the 17th and the 18th century. But what is really interesting is like this quality, this aesthetics that he managed to get with this technology that sometimes we refer to Ghanism, something like is like really typical of this type of models. So under the hood, Mario and the other artists that I will be presenting are using generative models, as I mentioned. So just maybe a quick introduction to generative model, what it is for those who don't know what it is. Usually, generative models are using training data, like most of the machine learning techniques. That can be images, text, sounds. Here is a painting by Gerhard Richter. And so that are provided to the generative model that would give an output, so something that should look like some that what we have as a training data. Very importantly, there is at the heart or the core of this type of model, there is a comparison function. There is something that tells you, okay, what you've produced looks like what I gave you as inputs. And this comparison is used for the generative model in order to drive the optimization and try to generate something that is the most similar to what there is at the training data. And I mentioned it very quickly when I was presenting Mario's work, but most of the artists that I will be presenting that are using this typical generative model that has been released by Ian Goodfellow and the team at Montreal, which is called Generative Adversarial Network, or GAN. So this model is 8 years old. There have been a lot of... it's one of the breakthroughs of deep learning. So we talked yesterday about maybe transformers, but GAN is also one of the breakthroughs. And there has been a lot of different extension of these models, and actually it's also used in privacy and security to build a very robust model that are robust to adversarial attack. So how does it work? It's basically, it's a dual learning system where we have on the top, we give some kind of stimuli, like a Z, which is noise, that is given to a generator. So this is a deep neural network. And so this generator is producing an image. And then we have also a discriminator, which is the D, that receive images from the generator and real images, something that's the ground truth somehow. And these images are annotated fake or real. And the goal of the discriminator is to be able to classify what is fake and what is real. So basically, the discriminator gets better and better at classifying real and fake images, but the generator gets better at fooling the discriminator. And so it's really efficient, it's really smart, and it gives a really good result in terms of generated image. So in this work, Anna Riedler is using this kind of model in order to produce these videos of tulips. And here she, through this video, she kind of enacts hidden stories behind tulips in the 18th and 17th century in Netherlands, and the link between tulips and their cost on the market. I won't go into the details, but I really recommend to look at her work. Something that I would like to stress, though, is that in order to produce this work, Anna Riedler went to take thousands of pictures of tulips. So she built herself the data set, right? And in this data set, she also annotated all the flowers and then feed this data to the generative model. And so what is interesting in her work is that she's actually presenting this as an artwork as well as the output of the algorithm. So for her, basically the artwork is dual. There is the data set, what is behind the scene that is usually invisible or anonymous, and what is the output of the algorithms. And the two are actually telling different stories. Another example is by Memo Acten that I'll show at the very beginning, but I wanted to present this piece here because it brings something really interesting for us as HCI researchers. So in this piece, we have, so it's called Learning to See, we have two screens, and we have a webcam on the table here. So basically the screen on the left is what is picked up by the webcam, and the screen on the right is the output of the algorithm. So the webcam take an images that is given to the generative model, and so this webcam feed is actually driving the generation. And so this is what it provides. There's a bit of sound, so I'm gonna put the music. So again, on the left there is the webcam, on the right there is the generation.
Sadly. Sunday, I waited and waited with flowers in my arms for the dream I'd created. I waited till dreams like my heart were all broken.
just turning down the music. So what is fascinating and also very interesting here is this, how Memo built a system that allows him to perform the machine learning system. So here is really performing, he's really trying to explore this stimulus space, this latent space, through webcam, but he did also other works in this idea. And he can change the kind of environments, like it was water and rocks, and then just by switching the model, you can also create really different types of aesthetics. So, what we wanted to do with this study is actually, is better understand how do artists involve machine learning in their art practice, and how does this technology influence their work in their social-cultural context. And for that, actually, we use the terminology AI. So you will see that in my talk, I won't talk much about AI, and that can be discussed. But for this work, we actually use the terminology explicitly. And AI was considered as two ways. Like first, as a technique. It's as a discipline that is studied in computer science, information science, or statistics. And in particular, here in this work, AI refers mostly to machine learning and deep learning. So here, AI is an inductive machine. So it means that it produces that the program that is able to give some outputs and is driven by data. But in this work also, AI is considered as a cultural object, in a sense that we also try to understand how the artists are taking integrating themselves and their work also in this culture that has long imagined other type of other forms of intelligence, in the literature, in movies, and so on and so forth. So here, AI is a cultural object because also the modern conception of artificial intelligence is actually derived from this culture, this idea to have a general intelligence, something that is suprahuman level intelligence, comes from this culture. And also, we wanted to stress in this study that AI, as understood, is an implicit culture vehicle, basically by being fed by data that has themselves curated and basically chosen by human, as these cultural biases or these cultural footprints, let's say, and let's not talk about biases here. And so, in a way, it's a kind of conveyance, kind of a summarizing or extrapolating these kind of cultural backgrounds that are used to build them. And so, based on that, we interviewed five artists that are world renowned: Memo Acten, J.K. Lewis, Mark Engelman, Kyle MacDonald, and Anna Riedler. And I will present some few findings to give you an idea what we found through this semi-structured interviews. First, I would like to present their typical workflow. So this is really low level, how they work with machine learning or artificial intelligence. So here, for instance, we have basically. One algorithm that has been released, so here is a StyleGAN that has been released on archive. So the paper has been released. Then at the same time, the authors released the code on GitHub. So this is quite common in the AI scientific culture. It's like you have a lot of, often the code is released with the paper, and often the paper is released before being published in conferences. It's published on archive, which is this open repository. So it's really fast. And we have some example of how what it does. Like here, there are images that you can find from this GitHub link, examples of what StyleGAN is able to generate. And so, artists basically what they do is they kind of clone this repo, this library, and usually they start by running the model like off the shelf. Like let's try to see what it does, and retraining. Maybe with replicating basically the result from the paper somehow in their own way. And very quickly they start this loop where they use their own data because that's what they are looking for. And here there is like all circle between using their own data but also changing their architecture or the parameters. And in order to provide something that looks like what they, what is their aesthetics and what they would like to do with it. And so this is quite important because this is kind of the workflow, kind of the practice of hackers, in a way. It's not here, machine learning or AI is not used as a service, is reappropriated. And what we found is that basically the artists are actually talking about machine learning as a, the work with machine learning and artificial intelligence as a craft practice, craft practice. So here I put the work by Anna Riedler, Myriad, and I give a quote from her that I'm going to read. I actually think that there are a lot of parallels between craft and art and between data and models. I think that there are a couple of things like the relationship between craft, which is anonymous and less well regarded, its repeated nature and the art. And when you see data sets are also anonymous and nobody talks about them. They're out there and people are using them. So she makes this parallel between, because for her, like building the data set is a craft practice. And it's kind of, she makes the parallel with the AI scientific culture where data sets are mostly anonymous, although they are open and they are available. Another aspect is that uncertainty is meaning making. Uncertainty is used, is embraced. So let's take this quote by Mario. So this is a piece by Mario Kingelman, and he says, "It reminds me of Francis Bacon. In fact, I feel closer to him. There is this work with oil paint. He looks for accidents. That's exactly the point. When you work with oil paint, it's also has this certain behavior where everything mixes. So you can't deliberately push in a certain direction. That's what he says. In working with it, there comes at a time when there's a certain constellation is right. Then you stop and you also have to decide, is this the best solution? Should I work on it? And that's what I found when I'm in my work, keep training and you may destroy it, everything. You may destroy everything. So it makes the parallel between like working with oil paint and working with machine learning in terms of training. And actually some of them said there is always too much training in their work. And lastly, that's something I already mentioned, but I think it's really important that this idea of performing machine learning, and this is a quote by Memo Acted, that he says, I don't want to worry about which optimizer to use or which activation function to use. This is for neural network. I want to be in a position where the research has been done. Right now, it's kind of like if an article came out one day and said, don't use this optimizer because it's so bad. You should use this one instead. It's very frustrating. So because his approach is much more experience-based. It's not like he doesn't want to know if he should put ReLU activation in the last activation layer. No, he wants to be able to have a more sense of an experiential sense of the models and experience it like this. So basically from these studies that I gave like snippets of it, I think what is interesting is this idea that this idea of shaping machine learning and the fact that artists reinvent a narrative of this technology. Basically they in a sense they gave space to surprise, to uncertainty that is usually kind of limited or framed in the AI scientific culture. And in their case, they are using it as a material. That's part of the work. That's part of the tool that they are using. And they are also creating interactive processes to better appreciate them. So that's really important. That's really important. So in a sense, they kind of resist an epistemology sometimes dictated by the AI scientific culture. And they are trying to bypass that. Something interesting also in the sense of shaping AI is that because often we can say, oh yeah, but who is the author of the piece if you are using a generative model? And actually artists, they do not question authorship, obviously. For them, it's not a question. Why is that? Because basically the artist is the one that makes it happen, right? So. When you see an artwork generated by generative model, by machine learning or AI, they know that it's their work, or they convey their aesthetics within it and their intention and their expression. So the problem then became when it's actually released in the contemporary art market, where actually communication kind of buys this discourse, this narrative. And in a sense, the third point is like artists have also a political voice that creates an alternative and critical discourse. And this is important, that's to come back to what I'm sort of saying in the beginning, that provide this alternative maybe perspective on how machine learning or AI is actually can actually be used. From this study that was based on the interviews, I would like to go maybe in maybe on a side slightly more technical of, but in a way you will see that is related to what I was just saying before. So now becoming like back to HCI researcher. Okay, as HCI researcher, we are conducting interviews to understand some phenomenon, and we are also designing systems. And in order to design system, you know, to probe them, to test them, assess them, we need tools. And I would like to stress the importance and the critical aspect of having tools that are suitable for composing and designing iteration machine learning. So this work is part of a discipline, sub-discipline in HCI. It's called interactive machine learning, which try to build interaction designs that involve the user in many steps of the machine learning pipeline, which means that the user is able to select features, select a model, change the metrics, so the quality assessment there on the top right, steering the model while it's training, decide when to terminate, so that's maybe remind us the quote by Mario, so when to stop training. It's not necessarily an easy question. And then also the transfer, so when to deploy it and how to deploy it. So here, the point is like, the end user is somehow can have access to all these different aspects. So the interactive machine learning research is quite developed in our discipline. This is really not exhaustive, but I would like just to show a few examples of what we do. So from the kind of seminal work by Fales et al. That has 20 years ago now, almost, trying to use interactive machine learning to build a image segmentation system by just providing with the pen, by just providing a notation where is the foreground and what is the background. And so through iteration, you can build a segmentation system quite easily and without not so much technical knowledge. Then we have the Wikinator that is developed by Rebecca Fibrink, which has been used and proposed for creative application. So providing the artist with the capacity to kind of explore gesture sound interactions without programming. Then there is some work from Wendy's lab, led by Joe Malloch, Field Word and Password, that has been shown yesterday. For gesture design. And last example that I'm showing is a work by Fred Oman from Apple has built this kind of interface that help ML developers to build a robust model, and that gives some kind of versioning to kind of track all the changing in the data, in the parameters, in the feature selection in order to be able to build the best model. So this is not exhaustive. Theo's work that he presented yesterday is really part of also in interactive machine teaching, is really part of this interactive machine learning research, as you will see. And what I would like to show is a toolkit that we developed with Jules Françoise and from Paris-Saclay and Theo Sanchez, that is called Marcel. And the idea here is like we realize that we are lacking a tool that enables us to build interactive machine learning system easily somehow, and something that is expressive and versatile. And actually we developed it first for pedagogical reason, because we are giving this course at University Paris-Saclay on interactive machine learning. And in order to convey the concept of this discipline to the students, we didn't find the right tools. It was either too closed, like the Wikinator, very good tool, but you couldn't really change it, or really too low level, which means like Python library, for instance, that that requires programming language skills. So we developed Marcel, and we developed it through an idea of architecture model that is based on components. So the idea is like, if I want to build an interactive machine learning system that is able to generate image or to classify things interactively, maybe I would like to like define a set of components that will define my system. For instance, a webcam input, a button to capture data, a data set to keep the data, a classifier and prediction. And these components have, not all, but have like interfaces that then we can compose. So the idea is like to be able to, on demand, compose the interface with these different components. And these components are kind of connected between each other. So what we have is like there is a bit of programming in JavaScript. Everything runs in the browser. In this example, you have like a sketchpad, something to draw. You have a data set. And in this video, which is accelerated, basically the user is adding a training button that is linked to a classifier. So when you push train, it triggers the training. And very easily, you can add some kind of classification plot, some confidence, where you can inspect the probability of recognition. So this is really fast, but it's to show you that basically how it works is like you program a script that is directly executed in the browser. So it runs in mobile phone, it runs in computers. So what we can do with that is that we first use case is actually a part of Theo's PhD is to imagine that you are an HCI researcher that would like to do some research on the interactive machine learning. So with that, you can build your application quite easily. You need to know a bit of JavaScript, but it's higher level than JavaScript. And there is like with this component-based architecture. So here, Suzanne is actually building a sketch recognizer, building a script with some kind of data set, a model, she's deploying this system to the crowd. And so this is a workshop that we did that Theo showed already yesterday. But something nice is like after the project, maybe so this works, but like, so that's a research project. There is like Shan who comes into play. Shan is a designer, and basically he said, "Oh yeah, I would like to use your system, but to put it in an exhibition in a museum, like a pedagogical exhibition." And so the work of Shan as designer doesn't have to change the script. The script remains the same. You just have to change the interface. And since it's HTML, CSS, and it's quite easy for a UX or UI designer just to appropriate the system and build an interface. So it's what happened with the sketch recognizer that is now shown in for 1 year and a half in Rennes and Nantes. Another aspect of this tool is like another use case is like since we can basically create different interfaces based on the same machine learning pipeline. We could imagine that is foster collaboration between ML expert or AI expert and domain expert. So in this example, basically we have a machine learning engineer and we have a domain expert. So the machine learning engineer is building the model, best robust model, and then is deploying or she's deploying the model to the domain expert, who in turn can actually correct the prediction and maybe make the model more robust. So this is a kind of a very quick illustration. So usually ML experts have their workflow in Python, so it's what we saw. This is the interface of the expert. She can choose the model that has been trained offline, monitor the training loss, the confidence matrices, and so on, trying to find the right epoch, test in real time the prediction. So this is an example in skin lesion classification. Trying to do some batch testing to inspect the confusion matrices. also inspect different models in parallel. So just by changing number of models, we can kind of in real time having a very customizable interface. And the thing is, once the model has been trained and is robust, basically the expert can choose to share the model to the expert. So basically here, behind the hood is exactly the same pipeline. It's just that the interface is different and the model has been updated. So now the expert can actually also navigate, explore the model, but also correct if needed. Okay, this is not the right prediction. So you correct, then the data might be updated and the model can be updated. And so with this kind of workflow, much more interactive, we can actually make the model deployment much more robust. Okay, so that was tool. So I wanted to present this tool because I think it's kind of interesting in this context of human-computer partnership, where we have different stakeholders, domain expert, ML expert, or end users. That can be here, we have one person of each, but it can be a group of people, and actually it's what we are exploring right now. And yeah, I think it's kind of been an interesting tool to kind of enact this more theoretical system that I presented before. Okay, I would like to present quickly now the last part of my talk, which is a project that is using this tool and is using the kind of approach that we saw in the first part of my talk, and I have 5 minutes for that, so I'll try to go quick. It's an ongoing project led by actually Hugo Scourteau and in collaboration with Thomas Similowski, who is the head of pneumology department at Hôpital Salpêtrière, and Samuel Bianchini, who is an artist and researcher at ENSAD. And so you will see why I presented this work, but basically this work stems from a bigger project where we try to create breathing objects for art and health. So the idea is like to build breathing objects because they have this breathing as this really is really strong empathy. So when you hear someone breathing, it can really calm you down, or it can also stress you out. And the thing is, like in the clinical context, also during COVID, there has been a lot of stress by people, and usually a lot of old people that has been accepted to the hospital in order to be cured. And since they have a tube in the mouth, usually they cannot talk, they cannot express their fear and the stress. And so the project comes from there, that where we wanted to basically build these systems that can be in the patient room and that can help relaxing or like focusing relaxing their world, lowering down their stress. So this project is, as I say, is a kind of multidisciplinary project with there is a part that is interactive art led by Samuel. There is a health part, respiratory care led by Thomas. That was what I'm gonna show is part of a postdoc, Hugo's postdoc, supervised by Thomas and myself. So more on this deep learning aspect and human-computer interaction. But then the project also includes soft robotics, computer vision, and music design. So what we wanted to do is basically, in order to build breathing objects that can convey empathy, we wanted to have expressive signals. And that's why we started to use generative model, the same kind of model that artists were using. And so trying to use this inductive machine by providing data and see if we can build a program that can be expressive. So expressive program means like this model is able, or this program is able basically to generate a lot of diversity, but also that the generative waveforms are also themselves expressive in a sense that they are conveying empathy or like some sense of realism. And so we transformed a waveGAN model originally proposed in the audio domain. This is our breathing data. This is our input data that comes from Thomas' team. So here are like people without any respiratory problem, without dyspnea, and we can already see that there is a diversity of behavior, respiratory behavior, and actually there is also individual signature in each one of them. So what we did, we took this thing and we started to build, we train a wavegun. Saying like this is like, oh yeah, we take, we train, and it works, but actually training, as I kind of show before, takes a lot of time, a lot of iteration. And so, and also the wavegun have this input that is really abstract, so we also plug a gain space, which is this, you can imagine it as a principal component analysis in the latent space that allows you to just extract maybe few controls that are the more suitable for exploring the latent space. So it's what we did. And what you see on top is actually the interface that has been built using Marcel. So here Marcel was really useful for us because as soon as we had a model that has been built, we could build very easily an interface that allows us to perform it. So actually I have a demo, but it's almost, so I'm gonna show the video later. It's gonna be a, and so what we did is actually, we didn't work as HCR researcher in our lab and then deploy our model. Basically, we did this system and we use actually assessment of, we assess our model by talking with Thomas, who is an expert in breathing. So there, we had this kind of back and forth relationship with Thomas and his team in order to allow us to say, oh yeah, now the model is good. Because we didn't have like objective metrics for that. And once we have this, we actually, in collaboration with Thomas, we kind of explore, we sample the possibility of the Ganspire, and we produce a diversity of breathing waveforms that we gave to pneumologists in Hôpital Salpêtrière in order to see what they would say about it. So what we saw is that basically some of them, so here is in French, but basically they realize how they annotated with really qualitatively, and they kind of also focus on details. So all this is generated by our model, and they say, oh yeah, look at the, there is this little variability here. It seems that there is something in the lungs that makes some this noise. So. This was really interesting because, like, you see the expressivity of this type of signal. And then we also asked them to rate how artificial or realistic it is. We had also another quote there that is basically here. What's, well, it's in French, but what is interesting is like this person, this expert, this pneumologist, basically felt empathy already seeing the waveform. Saying like impression désagréable, so it's like it's, you're not feeling well when you see that, and you're a pro because yeah, there is something wrong. And oh, we have something really really simple. It's beautiful, meaning that this is a sane, calm, relaxed patient. Okay, so I guess my point. So here is like more. Analysis, but I think it's not point. This is the video of the system, so you can see the interface that I showed you before that has been plugged. This is a machine that is used in the hospital to assist breathing. And so here we just basically visualize the waveforms, and it kind of feels already yeah. Relaxing. Okay. So just to conclude, I would like to conclude in 3 points. First, to maybe talk again about this, or stress again this idea of crafting under uncertainty. That is again something that is not necessarily obvious, but the thing is working with this type of, with machine learning is also, maybe we have to embrace uncertainty, embrace surprise and accident, and I think from the works that of the artist is what they are looking for in this. So maybe as a HCI designer or researchers and designer, we maybe have also to embrace uncertainty and build less prescriptive or deterministic interaction designs. Also, I wanted to emphasize the fact that in order to build something, we need some tools. And I guess this tool must be also built through the community. So that's why I wanted to present you Marcel, and I thanks all the contributors to the library, to the toolkit. And finally, I would like also to finish by saying that in this idea of rethinking interaction with machine learning, I guess here machine learning can really be seen as a tool, something that you use to achieve a task or an objective, but also as a material. You kind of explore, there is a generated epistemology while working with this technology. There is knowledge that is actually extracting from the use of this material, but also a cultural object. That the fact that we are using this technology is not neutral, is conveying a lot of cultural background. And the fact to use the term machine learning or artificial intelligence is also culturally loaded. And that's something that we have to acknowledge. Thank you very much.